Hello, everybody. Welcome to Book Talk. I am your host, Ryan Van Winkle. It is such a pleasure to be back in your ears for 2014, and what a fantastic episode we have for you today. We are going to be talking a little bit about the future in some small and large ways. On the podcast today, we have broadcaster and author Leslie Riddick, who has written a book called Blossom about the future of Scotland. We also have Hannu Raiomeni, who is an award-winning and very popular science fiction writer, who's going to talk to us a bit about the idea of neurofiction and kind of very much the future of the book. But first, we're going to start the podcast off with our good friend, Stuart Kelly. We sat down and had a very merry conversation to celebrate and welcome in 2014 with him. Stuart Kelly is a critic, an author, and he's also been a judge for the Booker Prize. So he's pretty well read. He's going to talk about some of the books you might have missed in 2013 and some of the books you're going to want to read this year. So, ladies and gentlemen, Stuart Kelly. You were really busy during 2013. You were doing three major things.
Did the Grant of Best of Young British. I did the Booker. Then I turned out to be the new director of Glasgow's I Write Festival. So, frankly, I've been slightly staggered.
Yeah, and by saying doing the Booker, you didn't write the Booker Prize winning book. You were one of the judges, the panel of judges for the Booker Prize.
I didn't write it, but I am delighted that we gave the prize to Eleanor Catton. When I first looked at the first page of her book, part of me thought, yep, winner.
And if you haven't read it yet, if people haven't read it in 2013, should they take it on? Because it's an ambitious novel.
It's very long. Big book, Ryan, of course. Yes, they should take it on. It is unbelievably ambitious. It's a combination of Wilkie Collins and Georges Perec. You know, she is both structurally very different and emotionally very demanding. And every time I've read that book, I go back to it and think, you know, you've done something very, very clever.
Is that part of the test when you're judging either for the Britain's Best Novelists or for the Booker Prize? Is that part of the test to see how, like, if you read it two or three times, if it still stands up? Is that part of one of the metrics to look at when you're judging something like that?
Absolutely, Ryan. Absolutely. Because, you know, if you want to see a book which is going to be something for the future, it has to be something which you have read and reread and reread and made the past part of the test about the future. And so, you know, with things like Eleanor Catton or with writers like Stephen Hall, I think, you know, we absolutely made sure that we had the future as much as the past in our heads.
And that if you took it on, it would be rewarding to anybody who wanted to read that book.
You know, I would give that book to my brother who doesn't read literary novels. I would give it to my mum who doesn't read literary novels, because it's basically just a great, thrilling, tub-thumping wee book.
Yeah.
And then when you finish it, you realise, actually, it's bizarrely clever as well.
And how important is it that people are doing something new, trying to write in a different style or doing things with the form that you haven't seen before? And maybe we'll get a little bit into this when we start talking about some of your picks for 2014. I think I know what one of them is. But how important is that in terms of the judging process? Because you've read thousands of books, Stuart. You've been a reviewer for The Scotsman for a very long time. How important is it to you when to see people pushing that form of the novel further than it's gone before, doing something different with it, that kind of ambition?
Ryan, when you see somebody basically pushing the form, there's a kind of a lightness in the heart. Somebody out there is still struggling to do something new. That's such a difficult thing to do. If you fail, at least you fail best.
Do you prefer a book that tries and fails or that doesn't try at all?
My loyalty always goes to ones who try, even if they fail. I can't deal with books which are mediocre. And, you know, you yourself wouldn't want a mediocre book, would you? And being great is about striving, and it's about changing.
And speaking of change, maybe, you're looking forward into 2014. You're putting on the I Write Festival there in Glasgow. It's going to be your first year doing it. You're going to be making this festival a little bit new, a little bit different, I imagine. Of course, you're going to be thinking about authors in 2014 who you want to feature at this festival. So are there books, are there exciting projects coming up that you've been reading that you think I need to see? I would love to see that person there. Are you going to get J.J. Abrams at the I Write Festival?
No, is the answer. But Ryan, you know, part of it, you said it's about writers. I don't think so. It's about readers.
That's good. We need more readers.
It's about where the readers are, where they are establishing their own communities of readership.
Yeah, and of course, your audience isn't going to be just tourists and people who are flying in for this festival.
Exactly.
It's going to be a lot more community-based and based around the people who are living in Glasgow, working in Glasgow, and of course, around Glasgow, and even Edinburgh, presumably.
Well, you know, I do believe that there's a train which moves between the two cities.
I've heard tale of such things, yes.
Yes, I believe so.
What will you be recommending people read on the if people are doing that commute every day of the year in 2014? Okay. What are some of your hot picks for
what I'm doing that cheesy way? What I'm going to recommend is read the J.J. Abrams novel.
And Doug Dorst, yeah.
S. Beautiful book. I would not ask anyone to take that on a train with them. There are so many things inside this book.
Yeah, I think maybe we need to explain. Explain just so...
Well, it looks like a library book. There are comments right the way through the margins. And as you read it, there are things inside the book as well. Things put into the book.
Photographs, maps drawn on napkins.
Photographs, maps. At one point, there's a lovely map, which, frankly, they managed to make it with the local university coffee shop logo on it.
I think I saw J.J. Abrams describe it as a bit of a novel and a bit of a piece of theater in the way that there's props. You know, they described the things that are inside the book, the little postcards and envelopes as props.
Oh, right. See, I don't think they're props. I think they're quite intelligently placed there.
It's such an interesting book because there's two, maybe three stories happening all at once. There's this sort of narrative that's the book, that's the library book. There's the conversation that's happening between these two people in the margins over time. And then there's this great mystery of who the author of this book is. And then, yeah, there's all this there's a lot of stuff happening in it. And it's
just a lot of stuff in it.
But it's great, and it totally works, and it's different than anything.
You know, is that the two readers might actually be the most wrong people about the book.
And then you start to see that a little bit. That creeps in, right? That's totally on purpose.
Yeah, it's there at the outset, I think. Abrams has always done these clever little tricks.
And this is where it goes back to what you were saying about making it new and doing something different. What does this compare to in your mind? Because I've not seen anything like it. But there must be something else out there that it's...
You know, somebody like Mark Danielewski.
Okay, House of Leaves, right?
House of Leaves,
yeah.
Who is going to be coming to Glasgow. He's amazing.
House of Leaves was one, and for people who don't know what that is...
It's one of the best books I've ever read. It's a very strange kind of nested novel. So you have a young man who finds a book written by a blind man, which is hidden in a fridge, about a film that the blind man has not seen.
And much like S in a way, I guess it has a lot of stuff that it would be footnotes and things, and the characters were kind of coming out through the footnotes in these.
Yeah, to an extent, but also, you know, the whole book was about, we've all done these kind of Pale Fire, Nabokov-style books. What Danielewski did and what Abrams and Dorst have said, actually, the postmodern is over. We've solved it. We have made it so that you cannot do a book unless you understand what we have done. Finally, we get to the point where somebody says, okay, step up, folks.
I mean, they're great, but what else are you looking forward to in 2014? Is there anything else?
Well, I've just read the new Jonathan Lethem, which is absolutely wonderful, which is about radical politics, basically from the 50s to the 90s. The Thomas Pynchon is great in the same way, where he's saying, we're forgetting how radical America once was. That's what I really hope for this year. 2014, the year where America re-understands just how radical it can be.
In 2014, actually, literally for America, we're going to be eligible for the Booker, right? Is that true?
Yes, you will be.
That's going to change things maybe a little bit.
It will change things, but mostly it only changes things because we do not need to be under some kind of imperial shadow anymore. Now we've got to be as big and as good as we can be. And honestly, who wouldn't want to lift themselves up and say, I can be that?
Thanks, Stuart. Everybody, make sure to get yourself a copy of S. I can vouch for it. It's totally amazing. Loads of really cool bits and bobs in there. Read it carefully. You don't want to lose anything that's embedded in the book. Always fantastic to talk to Stuart Kelly. Everybody, if you get a chance, make sure to go to the iWrite Festival. It's his first year directing it. It will be epic. And don't forget, if you download our previous episode, you'll be able to hear Stuart Kelly in conversation with Sasha DeBoole and Lois Wolf talking about the Booker Prize winning The Luminaries. And if you want to get involved in that conversation yourself, don't forget you can check out our website at scottishbooktrust.com or follow us on Twitter at ScottishBKTrust. Like us on Facebook. Always a conversation about books going on in those places. We'd be happy to welcome you into the conversation. Looking forward, it's a pleasure to have on the podcast Hannu Rajamäki. He's a Finnish author who writes science fiction, and he's been working on this project concerned with neurofiction. What is that about, I hear you asking yourself? I shouldn't be the one to tell you. Let's let Hannu explain it.
So the neurofiction project is an attempt to explore where books could go in the future. So traditionally, we've seen with books as these static things that act as repositories of an author's thoughts and stories, which are sort of permanent in nature. But actually, there's a lot of change that happens within us when we read books. We usually are not the same person when we read the same book twice or the second time. So we change, and those changes are reflected in our experiences of books. And
right, like, so like when I first read Catcher in the Rye, I thought Holden Caulfield was a mm-hmm. brilliant protagonist. And when I've reread it as an adult, I was like, oh, he's a jerk. He's a total jerk. Like, is that what you mean by is there more of a fundamental kind of change?
That's it. I mean, at the same time, of course, as in the reading experience itself, we construct kind of a very detailed simulation of the events in the book. And neuroscience has actually shown that as we read books, when we read about a character going through a series of activities, the same areas in our brains activate that would activate if we were actually doing those things ourselves. So it's a very, very deep immersive thing. So you could actually think of books as a kind of brain computer interface technology or a brain information interface technology. Obviously, now there's a lot of discussion going on about ebooks and how that's going to affect the future of publishing, future of writing, and future of reading. But something we, myself and my collaborator Sam Halliday, hadn't seen before addressed was how is this evolution actually going to affect books as a kind of brain interface technology. So we thought we'd take a very direct approach to that and create a sort of a book-like or a reading experience that actually changed or was directly affected by the brain activity of the reader. So kind of close this loop of the interaction between our brains and reading. So the experience that we ended up creating basically consists of the reader sitting in front of a screen wearing an electroencephalography headset, so a brain scanner device. So they're reading a short story, and their experience is pretty much what it would be reading a normal short story. But in fact, in the background, the story is changing based on what goes on in the reader's brain. So we can actually monitor how the reader is responding to each scene they read and then decide what scene we're going to guide them to next. So this is sort of the idea behind neurofiction.
What would that be like? Can you give me an example of what that would be? So you're reading something and there's a car chase or there's
I mean, you as a reader won't necessarily be conscious of what's going on. I mean, it's sort of, you'll just perceive a linear story. But what's happening is that the way we implemented it is we have certain specific qualities that we're measuring. So your kind of affinity with metaphors that have to do with life and death. So depending on which one of those, which you have more affinity to in a particular scene, will decide where to take you next. next.
So it can go thematically as well as kind of in terms of pace and in terms of excitement or in terms of danger and in terms of love or romance.
So one should sort of keep in mind that this is a little bit primitive in the sense that we can't really directly detect emotions. I mean, it's sort of the hardware at the moment is far too primitive for that. We actually had a sort of a nascent collaboration with some neuroscientists at Edinburgh University to try to see if we could actually really detect reader emotion. And in theory, we could have, but that would have required every reader to sit through a two-day sort of training session.
So you could figure out what makes it.
So whereas we wanted to do something where you could just sit down in front of a screen and have an interesting experience. So what we could do on the other hand was we could compare how you react to two pieces of text. So in the beginning of this particular story, which is kind of like a modern retelling of Snow White, and Snow White is all about sort of dual qualities, life and death, and apple is red or green and so on. Snow White is kind of a reflection of the evil queen, etc. So in this particular story, we expose the reader to a couple of passages that have a lot of metaphors and thematic words related to life and to death. And we kind of use that as a baseline to see what sort of brain activity we get from the reader. And then we actually use a sort of a relatively simple machine learning algorithm to compare those baselines to how the reader reacts to the next scene. And then we decide based on that where the story goes. So there's 48 different possible paths that you can take through the story with two different endings.
It's like a very subconscious choose your own adventure. Exactly. It's like
that's exactly what it is. I mean, the sort of we actually were thinking originally that was the direction where this thing could go. However, it sort of became apparent that it's very, very difficult to have a very immersive fictional experience that has multiple paths and multiple endings. So this is really because in fiction, the ending of a story, in some sense, has to be both surprising but inevitable, and it has to come from the personalities of the characters and the journeys and their evolution and what happens to them. So to capture the same quality in a choose your own adventure kind of thing, you would almost have to have several different characters or several possible evolutions that a character can go through, and that sort of gets combinatorially very very difficult. So in what we did instead here is that there's essentially the same story, but you can take multiple paths through it and have a slightly different experience and slightly different thematic emphasis based on reactions that you create.
So is this the kind of thing that's going to, as technology develops, so you won't necessarily always have to wear a helmet that is plugged into your brain, but this is something that like actually eventually will be on your Kindle or your iPad or whatever, and we'll be able to tell what you're feeling and doing based on your reading practice, just in general reading? Or do you envision people always having to sit in front of a computer to get this experience?
Well, I think technologically speaking, there's many possibilities. So, of course, a Kindle is already capturing quite a lot about you, like your reading speed and things like that. And now all tablets have forward-facing cameras. So people are already thinking about detecting micro-expressions and emotions of reader.
Temperature of your face, right?
Yeah, exactly. Things like that. So it's not necessarily to use a sort of a EEG style technology, but you could probably do quite well already based on expressions and other quantities that you can easily measure on a tablet. So I'm sure that will happen. I mean, it sort of goes very well with this general trend of trying to capture as much data about human behavior as possible, and reading is a big area of that. And then now we have the ability to sort of close the loop and start modifying text you're reading based on that. Now there are some, of course you can easily come up with some quite nasty scenarios related to that. My friend Charlie Stross, who recently participated in this thing called Sprint Beyond the Book in Frankfurt Book Fair, which was like a two-day exercise where a group of authors wrote collaboratively a book about the future of the book. He came up with this idea called feral spam books. spam books which are sort of algorithmically tailored to your particular tastes that actually insert themselves into your reading reading device for and take over your attention, and you'll find them compelling enough because they've been tailored exactly to the kinds of things that stimulate you that that you'll keep reading, and then obviously their creator or master gets some benefit from that.
Feral spam books, it's great. How has this research affected your own writing? I know you're the third part of your trilogy is coming out in, I think you said July, right? Has it affected the way you process, the way you write, the way you put books together, the way you put books out there in any way?
Not necessarily the last book, but the book itself that was completed a little bit before we did this project. But in general, it has made me think quite hard about what the possibilities of future storytelling are. And it's kind of led to sort of a nascent collaboration with a production company in the US. We're actually thinking that one thing we could do is not necessarily to think about the future of books, but actually create sort of a design fiction object, which would be a book from the future.
Yeah, and would you mind talking a little bit about the book?
Yeah, sure. So The Causal Angel is the conclusion of a trilogy of science fiction novels that began with The Quantum Thief. It's sort of the story of gentleman thief-like character who is very much confronted with various identity problems. So it basically starts with him getting broken out of a jail, a very, very futuristic game theoretic jail where you have to play Prisoner's Dilemma with copies of yourself. So he's broken out of this jail to do the one famous one last job, except in order to do that, he actually has to steal back his own memories. So that sort of starts quite a long three-book story about various adventures him and his kind of minder stroke frenemy called Mieli have on Mars, where in this moving city called the Oubliette, where time is quite literally money, and on a very broken sort of nanotechnologically altered Earth with sort of Arabian Nights overtones, and the sort of last book, The Causal Angel, takes mostly place around Saturn, which is populated by these this society called the Zoku, who are kind of far future descendants of World of Warcraft guilds.
What are you looking forward to in the new year? Anything in particular that's coming out in 2014 that you're very excited about?
On sort of a personal level, I'm quite excited about the fact that I've just co-founded a DNA nanotechnology company, which is so we're going to be building little robots out of DNA. So this is not science fiction; this is actual science with all kinds of medical applications, and that might actually involve relocating to Silicon Valley in the coming years. So I'm quite excited about that. It does actually mean I won't have time to read that much fiction, but I'll be reading an awful lot of molecular biology. But it is actually really, really exciting. I think, my background is in physics and mathematics, but I very much think that biology is where the really, really big problems, scientific problems are now. And I think that's actually also being recognized now in science fiction, that's going to be one of the areas that is going to be driving speculation as well as real science, as well as neuroscience and cognitive science. I mean, these are very exciting areas with lots of unknown possibilities, both for sort of real science and technology and storytelling.
Hanu Rayomeni, everybody. My brain is still hurting, but in a really good way. And don't forget, the latest installment of his acclaimed science fiction series is The Causal Angel, and it comes out this year. Check it out. Our last guest today, we're getting a little bit more local. We're talking about Scotland. We're talking about things that could happen in this country that might be of benefit to the people who live here and work here. We sat down with Leslie Riddick, who has written a book called Blossom, and it's about grassroots communities. It's about activism and doing things.
I'm Leslie Riddick, the author of Blossom. I suppose it's an attempt to make sense of living in Scotland for 40-odd years. It's a place that's beautiful. It's a place with a lot of community connection. It's funny. It's got a lot of social solidarity. But yet, it is still the sick man and woman of Europe. It's got chronic poverty. It's got incredible inequality. And it's almost impossible to get hold of land. And how does that all sit together? It's trying to make sense, really, of Scotland. And the subtitle of the book is What Scotland Needs to Flourish. And looking at all these different things, I was thinking particularly of the people I've met during my life who have usually been unsung heroes, folk who've tried to fix their own communities and have discovered, well, usually brick walls, to be honest, Some folk came out the other end, notably the people on the Island of Egg, for example. I was a trustee of that for 8 years. But for every triumph like that, against the odds, and usually against our own democracy and against officialdom, for every one that succeeds, I'd say there's about 10 or 20 that don't. And with them, they pull down everyone's hopes, aspirations, belief in democracy, energy levels, will to live even. It's not too extreme to say that in some areas. So it's trying to make sense of what it takes for us to get clear of some of that and to make the most of the jewels that there are in our society, which I think are being overlooked too often.
Before we get to the jewels, maybe, I'm really curious about this in the sense that at what point did these things, the synapses start firing and you realize it was all connected and could offer a solution, not only painted a portrait of a problem, but also painted a portrait of a solution.
When I had a deadline, this is why I'm a journalist, I think, because many thoughts can go through your head and you can keep an awful lot of balls spinning in the air and you can add more and you can confuse yourself and you can refuse to resolve them in a way into something coherent until you've got a deadline. And when that happens, boy, do the cogs start turning. So actually, it was the summer before last when I'd taken the whole damn thing away on holiday and had a eureka moment where I actually drew it as a blossom, as a flower, with the blight, the buds sitting on. I mean, I'm not a very good artist. They looked, everyone told me they looked more like thorns, but, you know, buds on something that couldn't blossom because of blight. And as soon as I got that kind of clear in my head, suddenly an awful lot began to pack in behind that. And the blight to me is just chronic disempowerment, which you can actually trace down to some quite identifiable and actually quite fixable things. And this is the other thing. In a way, people begin to get very despairing when there's a big task that's interconnected. And some of that is true. It will be a big change in mindset, at least for the authorities. I think most people in Scotland have already got a different mindset, which is why so few people turn out to vote. But it would also mean just getting down to some quite straightforward changes and stop being so grandiose about it. I mean, there's nothing we're tackling here that other people haven't tackled. Land is a pretty obvious one. People are constantly shocked to know that 1,000 people own 60% of the private land in Scotland. That makes us still, despite abolishing feudalism, but only very recently, the most effectively feudal society probably in the developed world. So much so that I'd guess a lot of people don't even see anymore what they'd want to do with land. We're that disconnected. We still have primogeniture here, which means the eldest son inherits the father's estate. If it's left to him in his will, his siblings can't contest it. Now, you might think, who cares? These are all wealthy people. I don't care if the, you know, a sister gets edged out. But actually what that means is the estates are handed down unchanged and they don't break down enough for anybody else to have, if you like, any chance of buying them. If we had a normal system, which is what happened in the rest of Europe since the Napoleonic Code in the 1800s, all siblings can inherit equally. I mean, that's fair. And that breaks up large estates, which in turn breaks them down to sizes that local people could possibly manage to get a hold of. And that brings land prices down. And it means that your children can buy and build houses near you, for example, which is now almost impossible in lots of rural areas of Scotland. I mean, the 10th Duke of Buccleuch, who owns pretty well half the borders, inherited all the estate from the 9th Duke of Buccleuch. I think he's got three siblings and they got 50,000 quid each. Now, again, my heart doesn't really break for them, but it breaks for everybody in towns like Newcastleton who cannot buy land for love nor money to have their children live near them. So this is a nonsense in a democracy. The amount of craven behaviour it creates, fear, cap-doffing, and all sorts of behaviours that you that come with watching over your shoulder most of the time, that kind of behaviour just has to go. And if you live in a city, I don't think you realise how common it is. But there's plenty of other things. We have the largest local authorities. In fact, they're not local. Probably in Europe, again, we have our average is 165,000. The average in the Nordic countries is 14,000. And the average, well, I say Germany, is about 10,000. We are way off on our own. We've got larger so-called local authorities in England. Now, what that means is that power is always remote. It perhaps contributes to a 38% turnout in local authority elections. And because we don't have anything that's community-based, we don't gather, harness the human energy that could contribute to people fixing their own lives. That might be the reason that there's actually a plethora of community effort in Scotland, because there's nothing structural at that base layer, if you like. In any other country, somewhere like Linlithgow would have its own council. Someone like Barra would run itself. St Andrews, good grief, the home of golf, heard, you know, known across the world, hasn't actually got the authority to, you know, decide to change the colour of the gutters. We have utterly disempowered towns and disempowered people within them, and that could change tomorrow. You know, democracy works when there's skin in the game. Democracy works when it matters what happens, when there's a budget in it and when there's elections. And so, for example, in Norway, there's 1 in 80 Norwegians stands for election. In Scotland, it's 1 in 2,000. And this is what it all means. In the end, we just have a very, it's like if we were a muscle, it's a weak muscle. And I think that feeds into the referendum debate, because we don't have enough commonplace use of democracy to just run everyday things, to then put this extraordinary event on top of it and find it an easy lift.
Is it happening anywhere? So somewhere like Egg? Do you feel like people there are more engaged, having gone through that massive battle to get the rights and the land that they do have?
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's partly because of the effort that they had. Yes, for sure. I mean, 8 years doing nothing else but having to organise to get £1.5 million to buy the island out certainly focuses minds. But then it seems to me, in the way that everyone tackles things, there's an earlier issue. I mean, the Egg people actually organise themselves incredibly well and intuitively. When they held meetings, there's always people who don't come to meetings, and they can often become a drag on a group because they don't come to meetings. They don't then know what's going on. They get grumpy because they don't know what's going on, and then that becomes a negative thing. So after each meeting, the Eggachs used to divide up the island, actually very much like a Church of Scotland elder system, and they would go out and go and visit everyone who didn't turn up to basically tell them what went on. And that didn't mean that they all necessarily became converts to the cause of the buyout. Some of them have never done. But they always knew that they had been included. And that sort of just intuitive, inclusive way of behaving has continued on. That was what was there in them always to be able to flourish. All they needed was the constraints removed to become the kind of society they actually already were. And they also were very low users of energy, mostly because they were stuck on diesel. So nobody had white goods. They all had generators. So, you know, basically the generator went off when the last person went to bed. And if you got up in the middle of the night, even in quite complicated houses, you just had to stall around in the dark to find your way to the loo until it went on again in the morning. Now, electricity means there's a combined hydro, solar, and wind system, which is pretty well 90%, leaves the island energy self-sufficient. But what they chose to do was impose a limit on themselves, which is a 5 kilowatt trip. So if they use more than 5 kilowatts in their houses, the house will trip and they have to pay to be reconnected. If you have a business, it's 10. And that just all that means is it's sensible. It just means you have to go and switch other things off before you put on the washing machine. But that's what I mean. They have chosen to stay. Some aspects of how they were living might have been a virtue of necessity, but they've chosen to stay with a very low carbon footprint, which they've actually reduced. And in that way, they've really shaped their future with all the powers they have to hand. Here's Egg. It's not an independent republic. It's not an independent country. And they have totally transformed their lives by having the will to use the powers they have. The other big one they've done is by giving young people land it looks like free, but if you sell it, you have to be able to pay back the portion of land that you have been given. So what it means is you get a start, and it means you can self-build. You can build with other young folk together. There's a straw bale house there. It's not all straw bales, that's the insulation. But there's lots of young people in really nice houses, which encourages them to have children and stay.
Because there's a massive exodus in a lot of these smaller towns and villages, and this is a huge problem. And everybody is moving to London or Berlin or wherever the big cities, Glasgow, and they're not staying. And that sounds like a very obvious way to help
Isn't it?
Keep the communities alive and vibrant. And so it's just not a bunch of pensioners you know, without a post office even.
That's right. So, you know, these guys have cracked the problem of the land, which the rest of Scotland has yet to tackle.
It sounds like once you get a taste of it, you can start seeing people switching on. Because so often in your life, you can't even deal with your phone bill hardly without talking to a human being, right? Like it's totally disempowering and hard. But it seems like once people get a taste of it, it totally expands and grows.
I hate to involve Ryanair in a conversation that up till now has been so learned. But you know, Ryanair had that philosophy. If you know, who thought they wanted to go to Exeter? Who thought they wanted to go to Knock? You know, who thought they wanted to go to these airports that are in the, you know, the middle of nowhere? And then strangely, when you put the route on, people go. And actually, as soon as Scotland becomes freed up, as soon as it isn't an arm and a leg to get hold of land, you haven't got somebody, you know, at the back of your neck looking over your shoulder all the time, this place will change. People will want things they've never wanted before. And people's behaviour will change in a way that will transform couch potato Scotland much better than any slogan or any current spending on health budgets.
Thanks, Leslie. Everybody, the book is Blossom. It is inspiring to talk to somebody like Leslie and to hear her ideas about what the world could look like if we just tried. And thanks to all our guests who appeared on today's podcast. Stork Kelly, everybody, don't forget to look at the iWrite website and find out what's going to be happening there. And of course, the great Hannu Rajamani. It's been a pleasure talking to you about books. Yank the earbuds out of your ears. Sit down, take a moment, enjoy a book for a little while. We'll be here when you get back with another great episode of Book Talk.